calendar. Counsel, you've been here before. Please remember you each have 15 minutes to present your case in chief. 5 minutes is reserved for appellate rebuttal if you choose to use that. I also want to remind you to introduce yourself to the panel as well as for our recording proceedings when you approach the podium and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of. With that said, when you're ready to go, we are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Amy Lawler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Jessica Stafford in this appeal. This is a case that first presents a question about whether or not Ms. Stafford can proceed under the post-conviction statute when she filed her petition for post-conviction relief more than 2 years after the date of sentencing. We have argued that under 590.01, subdivision 4.5, that she has filed a petition that is not frivolous. It is in the interest of justice, and it was filed within 2 years of the date that the claim arose. Therefore, we ask this court to find that the district court erred in holding that the petition was untimely.
And that could very well be the crux of your argument. It has to do with the whether it's time-barred or not, so maybe that would be a good point to start the argument.
Yes. If we lose that, we do lose the case.
What's the impact of a claim to get around the two-year rule in the interest of justice when you don't have an evidentiary hearing? What's the impact of a lack of an evidentiary hearing?
It was substantial, the impact, because there are a number.
Are there any cases where the claim was made that you could get around the original two-year statute by an interest of justice claim where there was not an evidentiary hearing? Are you familiar with any appellate cases?
I'm not familiar with any appellate cases that deal with the specific issue of the denial of a requested evidentiary hearing followed by a denial of the petition for post-conviction relief on issues that should have been addressed in the evidentiary hearing.
And the factors, are they susceptible of trial court determination without an evidentiary hearing?
I don't believe so, given the position of the state, which is that Ms. Stafford's waiver of counsel was knowing and voluntary, that she was in her full state of mind, and that the fact that she was not advised of her right to appeal and did not have an attorney had no impact on her decision. I think that those were issues that did need to be considered by the district court in an evidentiary hearing, particularly on the issue of the status of Ms. Stafford's state civil commitment.
Second question, what's the impact of the failure of the trial court to advise your client about the right to appeal under the rule?
It's crucial.
Any case law?
Not in this context. This case is unique in all the cases that I've seen because of the confluence of events. It's very rare to have somebody who is under a state civil commitment, who is pro se, who then pleads and then is still not advised of her right to appeal. And that is particularly true given the circumstances at the sentencing hearing where she informs the court that she now realizes that her plea had consequences for her in particularly the housing arena. She's no longer able to get into public housing with her baby because of this plea to a misdemeanor assault. So those are all, this confluence, I think, is what really makes this case stand apart from others that you might see where you might only have one of those factors. Somebody might be pro se, but they might not be under a state civil commitment, or they might have more experience with the criminal justice system and understand the right to appeal, or they might have had some other contact with public defenders or other attorneys who might have advised them. This case stands apart in the fact that all of these factors put together made it so that Ms. Stafford was unsophisticated, unrepresented on a state civil commitment, and didn't know about her right to appeal until she tried to file a pro se expungement.
You filed this under the interest of justice exception, and that
requires,
I mean, that's a different lens that we review this under as to whether your client knew or should have known of her claim. So aren't we in a position where it doesn't matter if she knew she had the right to appeal or not?
Well, no, I think that that does tie into the interest of justice exception because we have to show that under that exception, she filed it within 2 years of the date that the claim arose. And the state's position is that that two-year clock started running at sentencing, period. And our position is that because she was not advised of the right to appeal, that two-year clock could not start running until she knew about the right to appeal or to file a post-conviction petition. And that clock didn't start running until she filed her pro se expungement motion in October of 2017, and after that had gone.
What are you saying? That, well, the standard is an objective standard, not just a subjective standard, should have known, but also based on, but that concept encompasses the idea that the rules provide the trial court will let somebody know about the right to appeal. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I'm saying that under the objective standard, we can look at objectively what she was told and when she knew what. And objectively, she was not told of that right to appeal at the time of sentencing. Objectively, we know that the district court did not advise her of the right to appeal and that she did not have an attorney to advise her of the right to appeal. And so then we have to look at when should she have known.
Any comments to the rule that indicates what the consequence might be for the failure of the trial court to advise?
I'm not aware of any that exist under this particular context, but I think that all of this dovetails into the idea, and this is particularly under the Rickert case, that this is a broad inquiry, that the court is not constrained by any particular language of any individual statute but or individual rule, but needs to consider the circumstances as a whole. And then the circumstances in this case, this is an individual who is unsophisticated, inexperienced with the criminal justice system, and was not told of her right to appeal and didn't learn of it until late in 2017. And so with all of those factors, then you look at the question of whether this was not frivolous, it's in the interest of justice, and it was filed within 2 years of the date that the interest of justice claim arose. And I think that you can, putting those together, say that yes, that clock then started to run the date she became aware that she had the right to appeal.
Ms. Lawler, there was a colloquy, if I understand, between the judge and her about her mental illness, so it's not as if the judge didn't know about it, if I understand, even asked how she was doing, and so it was cognizant of it. And I think, am I right, she signed a plea petition, which included waiver of counsel, and the judge inquired about waiver to counsel. And so I wonder how much direct relevance at all to the discussion is the fact she was subject to a stayed commitment based on that colloquy and the judge's confidence of her plea when getting to the issue of knew or should have known under the Sanchez standard. In other words, how much more unsophisticated was she than any other pro se defendant who appears every day before court, signs a plea petition in a cattle call kind of scenario, I plead guilty and you waive, yep, sign, yep, do the factual basis and off we go. Wouldn't that open the floodgates to, and I'm assuming in most of those, unless the plea petition actually references the right to appeal, there's seldom, I'm thinking my own experience verbally, especially on misdemeanor cases, that you have a right to appeal, and if you want to, contact the public defender's office. So that's why the question's about the law. I'm curious, too, how that would get us past getting back to Sanchez, that she's presumed to have known on that day that you have a right to appeal, even though she wasn't told.
Well, and I think that, again, you have to first consider how unusual it is that someone who is under a stayed civil commitment shows up in court one day. This was not a scheduled appearance, just walks into court. She'd previously filled out an application for a public defender. She was eligible. She'd never met with one. She marches into court unrepresented and announces she wants to plead guilty and tells the court that she's under a stayed civil commitment. So the court at that point knows that under 253B.02 subdivision 13A, she's got one of the disorders, the psychiatric disorders that qualifies her for that stayed civil commitment, and never asks, why wouldn't you want to talk to a public defender about this? What does this stayed civil commitment mean? What is the current state of mind as you stand here before me today, and why are you making the decision in this way? It's unusual. Every step of this was unusual. And so, no, there's not a script that the district court is required to follow, and there's no case law that specifically tells the court what it needs to do under this particular circumstance with this unique confluence of events. But knowing this, when we know that the plea colloquy requires the court to make sure that they're not just advising the individual of their rights under Burt, but really making sure that they understand, and they've got someone before them who doesn't have a lawyer and has a substantial psychiatric disorder and does a very perfunctory inquiry, lets her plead and sends her on her way. And then, after that, at sentencing, still does not advise her of her right to appeal.
An option under the post-conviction, another exception for mental illness, would that not have applied then, given the point you really focused on her stayed commitment? Had you given consideration to that, and I frankly haven't looked at the law on that to see what sort of scenario, but would that have fit her situation better than the catch-all?
I don't know that it would have, in part because since we didn't have the evidentiary hearing, we weren't able to develop the record on certain key points. In particular, we don't know when the state civil commitment ended. The state implies in its brief that it should have ended after 180 days, whereas Ms. Stafford and her caseworker appear at court at sentencing and say she's still under that state civil commitment with a whole list of requirements. So we don't know why that is. We don't know what happened in Dakota County that led to the extension of the stay. We don't know what her state of mind was at that time, and we didn't get the evidentiary hearing to develop it. Because of the lack of record, but then tied with the fact that she was pro se and not advised of her right to appeal, I think it does fall under the interest of justice exception and that it is not frivolous.
And so the evidentiary hearing, again, with the evidence, I'm trying to understand the evidence that your client would have presented to get past the Sanchez knew or should have known, and you're focusing on when she first learned at the expungement of her right to appeal. And so that would be the evidence that would be presented first to see whether she has a Sanchez eligible, should we say, exception, that she's timely.
Yes, and that's certainly one of the things we would have presented. It appears from the transcript of her first appearance on the expungement matter that after she filed it, she happened to talk with someone who suggested that she go talk to a public defender. She did so, and then the judge suggested that she have the public defender file a post-conviction petition so that they could both be heard at the same time. So it appears that at that hearing, that's the first time anyone has given her any advice on the process to appeal her conviction is, and this would fall under Sanchez, the first time she knew or should have known is the first time someone told her. And that's because the judge hadn't told her before and she didn't have a lawyer to tell her before. She
Again,
just didn't know.
Wouldn't that change it to a subjective standard versus an objective standard?
I don't think so, because objectively we can look at the dates, we can look at the transcripts. We can look at the transcripts to see she didn't have a lawyer and she wasn't told at the plea and sentencing hearings. Then we can look at the evidentiary, or the first transcript of the hearing on the expungement matter, where the judge tells her for the first time to go ahead and have that public defender file a post-conviction petition for her. Those objectively are the moments, the key indicators of when she first became aware that she had any right to appeal.
Is there any indication in the rule that the notice the trial court is supposed to give to your client applies only to felonies?
I don't believe so. Under Rule 2703, Subdivision 5, the court is supposed to inform of the right to appeal. But even beyond that, I think the catch-all under 590.01, Subdivision 4B5, contemplates that there are going to be all sorts of scenarios that these courts will see that aren't going to be specifically identified by a rule, and that there are going to be circumstances that combine. And that's what really what happened here. It's not that any one individual thing stood out as being so particularly shocking or egregious. It's that they all combined together. And so I don't think that any other subdivision under 590.01 fully encapsulates how unusual this case was and allows the court to consider all of those factors together.
What are you asking us? Are you asking us to remand for an evidentiary hearing so you can develop the record more because you've complained about not having the record on certain items?
Well, I think the court certainly could just order that she be allowed to withdraw her guilty plea, but in the alternative, yes, we would ask that you remand for an additional evidentiary hearing on the matter. Unless the court has any additional questions, I will yield to my
question.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Alina Schwartz, and I represent the respondent. It is undisputed in this case that the petition for post-conviction review was filed more than 2 years after the sentencing. And the whole question becomes whether the petition was filed within 2 years after the petitioner became aware of the claim. Now, counsel correctly in...
Aware of the claim or should have been aware of the claim?
Should have been aware of the claim because the standard is objective and not subjective.
But you said aware, so you're not saying that that's 2 years from a subjective, I'm aware, but it's 2 years from when she should have been aware.
When she should have been aware, correct.
The question I ask counsel, I want to ask you, on the question of when someone should be aware, does the fact that the trial, that the criminal rule contemplates that the trial judge will give some notice to a defendant of the right to appeal, does that play into when someone maybe should have been aware?
I do not believe that that particular rule, the rule of the district court providing the notice to the defendants that they have a right to appeal, has any bearing on the fact of should or should have known when the claim arises. As the defendant indicated, as the appellant indicated in her brief, and also as the Sanchez case specifically indicated, the frame of reference is the date of the injustice giving rise to the interest of justice claim, and not the underlying substantive claim. And the defendant specifically wrote this on page 24 of her brief. And in this case, the frame of reference would be the date of injustice. The injustice that counsel alleges is the fact that the district court did not inform the defendant of her right to appeal. However, the counsel did not present any case law that would indicate that the remedy for failure of the district court to inform of the right to appeal.
So what is a rule without any remedy?
There is no indication as to what the remedy would be, specifically in it.
Should there be a remedy? Should it have an impact on some occasions?
As Justice Sleater indicated, it is extremely rare in cases, especially of misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor, for the district court to inform.
Well, maybe that ought to stop. I mean, if in fact it's in the rule, just because we are not following the rule doesn't mean we shouldn't we should continue to not follow the rule. Is that right?
That is correct. The rule does not indicate that the court has to inform the defendants of the time frame for the appeal, only that there is an appeal or there is a potential of appeal of their conviction or their sentence. In this particular case, there is no indication that the district court has done that. However, that does not...
Let's follow it along. If there had been a warning that you or a statement that you have the right to appeal the plea, you know, first of all, a pro se client would not think normally of appeal when you've filed a plea. Appeal would be after you have a trial. But to be known, to be aware that you could appeal even a plea, that would drive somebody more likely to seek a public defender or seek an attorney. And the time frame from knowing or having reason to know would be much accelerated, would it not?
I believe that the time frame would still start at the time when the defendant enters into a plea, or in this particular case, when the defendant is sentenced, because that's where the alleged injustice would have arisen.
The factors, from the factors to establish a claim in the interest of justice to get around the two-year rule looks somewhat fact-specific. How does a court make that determination without an evidentiary hearing?
In this particular case, there was no new evidence discovered. There was new facts that happened during this three-year period, or almost the three-year period after the sentencing. Everything the defendant alleges goes back to the time of the sentencing. There is no indication at all that there was any discussion of the appeal at the time of her expungement hearing in October of 2017. In fact, what the district court suggested at the time when she was discussing her expungement was to potentially go the route of the post-conviction relief. And at that point, she sought the advice of counsel. And also, I wanted to bring up to the court's attention...
I don't know that you've answered my question. It just seems to me that it's one thing to deny a post-conviction a remedy where the record is clear and we're not dealing with items that require some fact-finding. It seems to me that where there's a claim in the interest of justice, however, and we have a five non-exhaustive factors that the trial court is required to take into consideration, that it's very difficult to expect the trial court to do that without an evidentiary hearing. And we're left without findings on these factors for review.
So when the facts alleged in the petition conclusively establish that the petition is untimely, the court can summarily decline to conduct this evidentiary hearing. And in this particular case...
Not when there's a claim of interest of justice that requires the trial court to do more. They simply say 2 years is up, too bad.
In order to have a hearing under this exception to the rule, the petitioner has to show that the claim was timely and that the claim was done in the interest of justice. So if the court determines...
Are you familiar with any case, appellate case, that where there was a claim that the two-year rule can be circumvented because of the interest of justice claim, where there was not an evidentiary hearing?
There were several cases where the evidentiary hearing was declined. I do cite them in my...
Where there was a claim in the interest of justice?
Yes. There was one case that I cite. They had two exceptions that the appellant in that case was alleging. I do cite that case. I believe it was a Gessler case.
I'm sorry?
Gessler.
Gesslin?
Gessler, it's G-A-S-S-L-E-R. I believe that's the case. In that particular...
You cited that on page 8 of your brief. Just for reference, it's on. You are citing to that on page 8 of your brief. And as I understand it, you're...
The Gessler?
Yes.
Okay.
And in that particular case, the appellant, I believe it was Gessler case, in that particular case, the appellant actually used two exceptions. One of the exceptions was newly discovered evidence, and the second exception was the exception of in the interest of justice. And I believe in that particular case, the court declined or did not conduct the evidentiary hearing. The court did not grant the petition for post-conviction review. Now, I have to note that Gessler was later abrogated by, I believe the case is Henderson. I did not cite that particular case, but it was not abrogated on the point that I was using that case in my brief. Now, one point that I wanted to make is that the defendant counsel indicated that it was only later on, sometime at the time of expungement, when the defendant figured out that her plea interfered with her ability to find housing for her and her child. However, counsel indicated in her appellate brief that at the time of sentencing, the defendant was aware of the consequences of the plea and specifically was asking if the judge would allow her to have a stay of adjudication because she was concerned that her plea under the terms that the state was offering may interfere with her housing. And the state had this discussion on the record with the court where the state indicated that it will not feel comfortable to change the plea agreement from the stay of imposition to the stay of adjudication. And the court followed through with the negotiations between the state and the defendant, whereas the stay of imposition was imposed on the defendant. And that also goes to support the findings that, or the court's conclusion that there was no further inquiry was needed in this particular case based on potential allegation of incompetency. Now, the defendant was put on a state of commitment on the 14th of May, 2014. By the time that she pleaded guilty and by the time that she was sentenced, it was way past the 180 days of the commitment, state commitment.
I was intrigued by Ms. Lawler's alternative remedy, and I wanted to kind of hone in on that a little bit. That's part of that's the questioning you've been asked already. Because generally, while we might presume the date of sentencing in the normal situation is when the clock starts to run, but if the injustice is later and part of here, it seems like the facts that at least in a normal situation a judge would do like this, look at the transcript perhaps and look at what happened and simply say no. But you have all the factors here lining up to at least a reasonable argument, which would seem to suggest we need some evidence for the judge to make that determination, meaning the pro se, and that in and of itself perhaps is not a big deal, but without counsel, pro se, and then added to that the civil commitment. And so while a different standard doesn't rise to a Rule 20 when faced with a post-judgment motion, to be able to address that issue of the timeline, wouldn't it be reasonable and necessary to hold some sort of a hearing to really learn what the status of her mental illness, how that affected her ability at the time of sentencing, it's to come up with a two-year time period, even objectively, to see if she's timely. And then if she is, of course, proceed, and if she's not, then it ends at that point. Something more, in other words, and that's the point for us then to review also.
It would have been important to conduct the hearing, had there been any indication that at the time of the sentencing there was any need for further inquiry. In this particular case, there was no need for further inquiry based on the defendant's demeanor, based on the way she conducted herself, based on the additional questions that she was asking during the plea, and also based, in this particular case, there is sufficient record in the transcript as to what happened and what transpired during the plea and during the sentencing. The defendant eloquently discussed her condition with the judge. She was able to indicate all kinds of treatment programs that she went through. She indicated how much better she was doing. She indicated that she was back on track. And also, the case law is specific that the defendant is competent to stand trial in a criminal matter if the defendant has sufficient present ability to consult with the lawyer and also to rationally understand.
That rule assumes there is a lawyer to consult with.
If there is a lawyer, correct. And to rationally understand factual basis and the proceedings. In this particular case, the defendant was representing herself pro se. And that's why the court went through the exchange with the defendant. So did the state.
One of the elements of the interest of justice, one of the factors, is the necessity to protect the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of judicial proceedings. Where the trial court doesn't give the notice of the right to appeal on a plea of guilty, and where there's a claim made without a evidentiary hearing, do those factors inform us at all on the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the judicial process?
I don't believe so. I think that the crux of the argument, at least based on the brief, on the appellant's brief, is that her plea and her waiver were not intelligently, voluntary, and knowingly given. And everything that we have as far as the record in this particular case, both at the time of the plea and at the time of the sentencing, all indicate that there was...
We know apparently that she had applied for a public defender and that she was eligible. Do we know what happened? Was she appointed a public defender? Does the record reflect what happened after she made that application?
Yes. So what happened after she was charged, she was to attend the arraignment. She appeared at the arraignment, and she was appointed a public defender. After that, she was to appear at the pretrial. She failed to appear, and a warrant was issued. After a while, I believe about a month, maybe a month and a half has passed, and that's when she walked in and she chose to plead guilty, and she was representing herself at the time.
Any discussion, anything on the record as to whether she in fact saw that public defender?
Not whether she saw that particular public defender, because what happens...
Go ahead.
What happens when the defendants fail to appear, the public defender's office is being discharged once the warrant is issued.
So when, is there anything on the record as to why she failed to appear?
No, and typically the court does not. It's not in every case that the
we
court
don't
makes
an. We have a record as to why she didn't appear. We don't have a record as to whether or not she, in fact, was advised by counsel after counsel had been appointed for her. Is that right?
I don't know if she had any discussions with the public defender that was appointed to her.
And you think under those circumstances there's no issue of fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial process to not even have an evidentiary hearing to find out a few of these things?
That is correct, because this particular exception, Exception 5 of the rule, is available only in exceptional and extraordinary situations. This is not one of those exceptional and extraordinary situations, despite of the argument of the appellant.
Did the trial court make an inquiry when she walked in and wanted to enter a plea as to what happened about your lawyer? You were appointed a lawyer. Did you talk to a lawyer? Any inquiry on that subject?
I did not see that on the record provided to us, and that would be very typical because once someone fails to appear or warrant issues, then a public defender's office is being discharged. So next time when the person...
But I would assume that there was some time between the appointment date and the failure to appear when it would have been expected that she would talk to the appointed lawyer before that next hearing.
I don't know if she had a chance to speak to her attorney any time before she failed to appear.
Well, we don't know because there's no record.
That is correct.
Might have had a record if we'd have an evidentiary hearing.
Your Honor, I believe that counsel in her appellate brief indicated that after the defendant was appointed a public defender, she did not have a chance to discuss the matter with the public defender.
When she appeared in court after the warrant, well, the warrant was issued and then she voluntarily appeared in court, did she go through an adequate waiver then of her right to counsel? Was she offered that ability to be represented again? That wasn't, it's not up on appeal, so I presume that happened.
She did go both on the record and in writing over her right to be represented by an attorney. When she appeared before the court, counsel called it perfunctory. However, the court on several occasions asked her if she's comfortable representing herself, if she understands what she's doing by waiving her right to an attorney. She also, in addition to responding affirmatively to these questions, she signed a plea petition that indicates to her that she has a right to be represented by an attorney. If she cannot afford one, one will be appointed to her. And she asked a lot of pointing questions and a lot of questions that would indicate that she understood what she's entering into, the maximum penalty, the enhanceability for this particular offense. And also, as part of this negotiation, the defendant had one of her other files, also domestic assault files, dismissed.
Can I just inquire, by the way, when she walked in, the warrant was still outstanding?
That's my understanding, that she turned herself in.
So the point being is she's standing before the court with a warrant outstanding, and so I'm assuming even if she didn't plead guilty, she was going to either have to pay the bail, a bond, or the court would have to quash the warrant because she showed up, but that hadn't yet been decided?
That may have been the case.
Okay.
I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the two cases that opposing counsel started her argument discussing, Sanchez and Gassler, because I think both of those cases are actually helpful to Ms. Stafford in this situation. The first...
Was she correct that Gassler was a case where the claim was made and there was no evidentiary hearing?
My understanding is that Gassler was a tried case. Gassler was represented by counsel and went to trial, and the post-conviction petition had to do with the evidence concerning his guilt. And so my understanding is there was not an evidentiary hearing there because the issues that he raised had to do with all of the evidentiary issues that had already been fully fleshed out at trial by counsel, which is, of course, entirely different from what we see here. And I think Sanchez in particular is helpful because, as we discussed in page 28 of our brief, Sanchez sets out this objective standard, but it notes as the objective standard, it notes as the date at which that claim arose was the date that the district court told Sanchez that his appeal had not been filed. So it really specifically points to an action by the district court alerting the defendant to his potential claim. And then if you look to the expungement hearing transcript, page 5 at the very bottom, Ms. Stafford says, I just have a question. I was under an MICD commitment. She's asking what she can do about her conviction. And the court says, you would have to bring a motion to ask that your plea be withdrawn, and then directs her to the public defender. And I think that this is incredibly similar to Sanchez in that it's that moment at which the district court alerts the defendant, you have a claim. And just like in Sanchez, that is an objective moment at which for the very first time the defendant is told, here's what you need to do to address your conviction. So the cases that that the state here is citing, including Sanchez and Gassler, I think are very supportive of Ms. Stafford's position, which is that the very first time she's ever told by the judge what to do is in October of 2017, and within 2 months she's filed a petition for post-conviction relief. You add to that she never before had a trial, never had any sort of evidentiary hearing, didn't have an attorney. And then you also can look to the two cases that the state cites in its brief, Carlton and Rickert, which I think are also helpful. That in Carlton, the individual had an inexcusable delay, which is, of course, not the situation here, where Ms. Stafford has not done anything to delay this, and in fact, very promptly, as soon as the district court told her what to do, went out, got the services of the public defender's office, and we filed the post-conviction petition within a month after she contacted us and was appointed our representation. And then if you look just broadly to the language of Rickert, it allows this court to consider all of the factors that, that Judge Klapacki was discussing in his questions with the state, which is, this seems wrong, that someone walks in under a state civil commitment with no attorney, for no apparent reason chooses to forego the services of the public defender's office and plead guilty, and the court doesn't tell her that she has the right to appeal or ask any probing questions about the state of her mental illness or why she's choosing to forego a public defender that she is eligible for. None of this altogether makes sense, and all of this added together with the moment that the court tells her how to challenge her conviction, all of this shows that she falls under that interest of justice exception, and she should receive a decision on the merits about whether or not she should be allowed to withdraw her guilty plea. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing today. Your arguments were helpful. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame.